Welcome to Story Smack. This is Story Smack, a podcast about stories and storytellers in the world of pop culture. This week, we're discussing the 1986 cult classic Big Trouble in Little China. FDO, can you give us an intro?
First, yes. My name is Scott Sigler. I'm number one New York Times bestselling novelist, and we're all getting on the Pork Chop Express.
We're going to drive a very large
truck through very, very tiny, tiny streets.
Absolutely. Yes. And as always, we are blessed with empty set movie maven Rob Otto on this cast as well. Rob, how you doing?
It's all in the reflexes. It's all you need to know.
So we normally start this Story Smack podcast by you taking on your movie announcer voice
and giving us
a synopsis.
Yes,
this
we
week we are talking about Big Trouble in Little China, if you haven't guessed so far. So can you give us the rundown?
The official movie synopsis is like one sentence long. So I went to IMDb and got what I think is a good one.
Is the official one like just watch this? Just watch it.
Yeah.
Don't. We don't know what we're doing.
The official one is like watch it or don't. We don't care. We already made our money. Which they didn't. Here we go. When trucker Jack Burton agreed to take his friend Wang Chi to pick up his fiancée at the airport, he never expected to get involved in a supernatural battle between good and evil. Wang's fiancée has emerald green eyes, which makes her a perfect target for an immortal sorcerer named Lo Pan and his three invincible cronies. Lo Pan must marry a girl with green eyes so he can regain his physical form. Now, Jack must save Wang's fiancée from Lo Pan and his henchmen and win back his stolen truck. But how can he defeat an enemy who has no body? It's not a very good synopsis.
Well, I mean, everybody deserves somebody.
They do, or nobody.
Or nobody.
An enormous amount of unclear antecedents for the pronouns in that since I'm in the audio booth right now recording the Stone Wolves audio.
There is quite a lot of cursing about antecedents.
Very cognizant antecedents.
A lot of complaining.
Super important.
Want me to give you the financial rundown?
Yeah, let's talk about it. I always like talking about the money of these movies. So let's get
A big deal because back in 1986, it cost $25 million to make Big Trouble in Little China, which is about $59.6 million in today's dollars.
Okay.
It bombed at the box office. I know you're surprised. Making back $11.2 million worldwide. Yep. Ouch. That's 40% of the production budget. That is not the direction you want those numbers to go.
It was not good, which we're going to get into in a little bit. But
makes
first
me
of all,
feel bad all over again.
We're going to give you our high-level thoughts about the movie. Then we're going to start breaking it down character by character, actor by actor, bit by bit. Let's go with Rob. What are your general thoughts on this movie?
Well, the numbers really tell the story of this movie. The production company, 20th Century Fox, thought they were getting one movie and they got a different one. And they screwed up every step of the way with this movie. Essentially, guys, in the U.S., they released this movie for 1 week. And then it hit nowhere near the numbers. So they pulled it out of theaters. 1 week. Is what they gave this movie. And we're talking about it 35 years later. So, yeah, they screwed up big time with this one. And they were fingers all in it. They changed it. They never understood this movie. And thankfully, people found it on VHS.
Yeah, for sure. And there are a handful of success stories like that, for sure. We'll get into that a little bit as well. This is another interesting movie. It's a throwback. This is an anniversary for this movie, right? Isn't it like the 35th anniversary
35,
for this?
Yeah.
And I am always interested in movies that hold up for whatever reason they hold up. And this is a fascinating one because it holds up and I still don't know why. I think we'll talk a little bit about this later, Rob, in our chat before the cast. Rob brought up that it's essential for Jack Burton to believe he is the hero of his own story. And I think that's my favorite part. Like, he just swaggers into every room and he's not belittling anyone else as much as he's puffing himself up. And I will always love that. And I don't know why they pulled it after a week.
Yeah. And of course, as everyone knows, Big Trouble in Little China is the Citizen Kane of all action, adventure, comedy, kung fu, ghost story, monster movies.
And, I can't think of a better
that's
one.
True. That's not a bad.
It's the king. That's how John Carpenter described the movie. And from that perspective, he hit it right on. Hit the nail right on the.
Yeah, he knew what type of movie he was making. Just the studio didn't. Can we talk about our beverages? Are you guys beveraging?
Yeah, we are. This looks beautiful. What are you drinking?
Well, I made a San Francisco. I figured it was apropos.
How smart.
And there's actually a San Francisco made with sloe gin and vermouth. That is not this one, even though that would work in this glass. But this is a San Francisco with vodka and triple sec and just a little bit of grenadine. So
it's
cheers.
Beautiful. It looks beautiful. Scott is drinking a blackberry smash because we have blackberries in the grocery orders this week, and he loves blackberries. So I made a blackberry smash, and I'm drinking I'm drinking Fresca.
Oh, you want a Fresca?
I'm hanging photos at my house, I'm doing
this.
That.
Here you go, there we go. That'll fix everything right there. All right, very, very nice, very nice. Let's get into the cast. I love talking about the cast. First, a lot of people don't know there's a really weird, weird backstory to this movie. And Rob, we have to talk about the screenwriter first. Tell us about that.
So originally, this was a movie set in the Old West, right? Mm-hmm. That's where its roots were. He was supposed to be, Jack Burton was supposed to be, you know, delivering like meat to the Chinese rail workers as they were making, you know, the rails. And they uncover this whole Lopan thing while they're digging the railroad tracks, right? That was the original movie. And you even see some throwbacks, like the weird moccasin boots that Kurt Russell wears and the duster he wears at the beginning of the end.
And the saddlebag.
The saddlebag,
yeah, sure.
Right, that he carries all his crap around in. So, and when Carpenter read the first script, he said it was unreadable. So he gave he gave it to Walter Hill, who wrote 48 Hours. He was the first one they wanted to get to rewrite it. And he said, no, I can't do anything with whatever this piece of crap is.
Oh, no.
So then, thankfully, W.D. Richter, who's the guy who directed Buckaroo Banzai, right, which is just an off-the-wall, fantastic, you know, 80s extravaganza, weird movie.
Wonderful.
And he had the sensibility to understand what he was looking at. And so he threw out most of the original script to the point where Goldman and Weinstein aren't even credited as writers on this movie. It is just W.D. Richter who rewrote it. And he's the one that turned into it. And this is the crazy part, right? When you look at this movie, did either of you think of Rosemary's Baby?
No.
Nope.
Did not.
No, you did not. W.D. Richter did. And and the thought being that there's the real world that everyone perceives. And then there's this weird kind of second underworld that only some people ever experience in their life. So the same way that the devil worshipers in Rosemary's Baby were acting on a level that nobody else realized, is the same way he kind of created Lopan's reality below Little China. And that was it. And so they wanted a big, strong lead, and it ended up being Kurt Russell.
And the guy who started this script was Gary Goldman, who went on to write Total Recall. So it's very interesting that he had such a bad script to start with.
Yeah. It's not that he was a bad writer. He just wrote a bad script.
Right, which we know certainly happens, because we've all seen movies that are that should be good, but they don't quite hit, and it's one of those things. I think one of the things that made this story last and become the hit it was once it was found on VHS or whatever is certainly Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell plays this part, I think, pitch perfectly, and at the time, he is somewhat new, not really new in his career, but the movies that he's done to this point prove his worth and prove that he can pull anything. Quick note, if you guys hear some sort of noise in the background, they're re-roofing today where we live, and they're right above us sometimes.
And he wasn't new at all. He'd been a Disney actor since the 60s.
Well, right. I guess I meant in his leading man fame.
Sure.
But the movies that he did before he took on this one are going to be no surprise to anybody. They're Escape from New York. You've probably seen it. If not, you should. This is about everything on this list I'm about to talk about. He did The Thing in 1982 before Big Trouble in Little China. Big Trouble comes in 86, and he does Stargate in 94. And then is eventually all the way up to 2007, he's in Guardians of the Galaxy. So he has a long storied career in Hollywood playing this sort of guy. And one of the wonderful things about Big Trouble in Little China is he has great comedic chops, and he's good at being a surprise in the role that he's in. And you see some of that in Overboard and Death Proof, which comes later in the 2000s, which is awesome. You see that in Tango and Cash, obviously. Like, he's got to have a real solid handle on his leading man status to be in Tango and Cash and make that movie funny, you know? And I think he does a great job. but then also he and John Carpenter, they have a pretty big history too. They did, what was it in 1978? They did
Elvis.
Elvis in 1978. 2 years later, they paired for Escape from New York. And then after that, they pair together for The Thing. So this is another thing that you find over and over again, where an actor and the director have this symbiotic relationship where they know their strengths and weaknesses, and they know the other person's strengths and weaknesses too. So then he eventually does in 1986, of course, he does Big Trouble in Little China, and he turned down the lead in Highlander to take this role.
That's impressive.
Well, now, here's the thing. It's probably regrettable at the beginning of Big Trouble in Little China's history, but it grows into the right decision, I think, probably.
Yeah. And the studio.
Well, actually, it goes into the right decision for the other movie, too, because that's such a classic, and I don't know if Kurt Russell pulls it off the way
that
they did that.
It's a good point. Yeah, it's a good point.
Honestly. It would have been fun to see.
And the studio at the beginning wanted either Clint Eastwood or Jack Nicholson to play Jack Burton, but both were working on other films at the time, and Carpenter wanted to work with Russell, so that's where it ended up, and I'm happy for it.
Yes.
Do you guys think we get the comedy that we get from Kurt Russell in Jack Burton? If it's either Eastwood or Nicholson?
Eastwood's not known for his comedic timing, although he did Any Which Way You Can, Any Which Way But Loose. Those were fairly funny. But,
I think, though, the choice of co-star there, and I'm not being sassy at all, I think the choice of co-star there really matters. It's easy for him to kind of cut up against an orangutan. I'm not being sassy, really, though. Like,
you're right.
If he's this big, serious actor and he's done all these gritty things, like, you can't really do that unless it's a kid or an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And a cute orangutan is the way to go, I think.
There was sort of a not cute orangutan in this movie, some kind of monster. And
that's true.
Which was very orangutan-ish. It could be Clyde. And then, of course, we have the history of work between Kurt Russell and director John Carpenter. John Carpenter, also a legend of sci-fi and horror comedies. He is the writer-director of most of the Halloween series. He did Escape from New York, of course, Assault on Precinct 13, The Fog, They Live, which is an ultimate classic, which we'll have to cover someday. They did, he did Christine, he did In the Mouth of Madness. And for Big Trouble in Little China, he reunited with cinematographer Dean Cundey, who shot Halloween, The Fog, Escape from New York, and The Thing with Carpenter. So a very experienced team. He's also, of course, a musician, and the guy who wrote that timeless Halloween theme. Dun, 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 dun.
You know, that's right.
It's huge.
Every Halloween you hear that song. And this is one of my favorite parts. He also he was in a band called the Coupe de Villes. And the Coupe de Villes performed Big Trouble in Little China's theme song, the title song for the movie. And that is John Carpenter's band. And holy crap, you guys, the video is absolutely amazing. We're going to go ahead and take a look at this.
He's just an absolute beast. I love it.
We're going to take a look at this right now. Well, that didn't work. Okay, so we're looking
over here.
You're
going to
ride the sound? Here we go. And we'll probably get some kind of copyright violation. But those of you who've never seen this, you're going to love it. Here we go.
Enjoy.
There's nothing more 80s than this.
So synthy.
This is not Adam Sandler, you guys. And the keys.
How has no one redone this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, go down for it.
And for those of you listening at home, this guy looks exactly like Adam Sandler. I thought I liked Adam Sandler. I don't know.
I wish I could have found my tweet jacket.
Yeah.
If you are listening to this on the podcast, not joining us in the live stream, we do every other Saturday, you are going to want to go to YouTube and look up the Coupe de Villes, Big Trouble in Little China. It is absolutely spectacular. It's John Carpenter in the editing room, rocking out while he's editing.
But here's an interesting side note for the Siglerverse. this room that we're in right now is Scott's office, and he can just as easily write a novel as he can produce a song in this room. So maybe John Carpenter had just set up his editing studio and his music studio in the same room. You know, with lots of skinny ties.
So we have Kurt Russell, we have John Carpenter, we have a script. We have to get to our female lead, who has, since this movie, gone on to become a massive star. It already was well on her way. Rob, talk to us about Kim, the lovely, amazing Kim Cattrall.
Yeah, Kim Cattrall is probably one of the, well, I was about to say one of the most accomplished, but we're about to get to a couple of guys who are way more accomplished than Kim Cattrall, right? But yep. Leading into this, she was a known commodity, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she'd done a lot of TV work, a lot of episodic stuff, Charlie's Angels, Logan's Run, Tales of the Gold Monkey. Then her big hit came in Porky's in 1981, yep. Right? Mm-hmm. And we all real fond of Lassie. I know that was an important time in my life. And then
everybody was like, wait a second, I have tube socks. I have tube socks. Maybe I can get Kim Cattrall.
Yeah, exactly right. Except I was using my tube socks.
I wasn't gonna. As soon as I said it, I thought, oh, maybe that was a mistake. Oh, that was a mistake. That was a
conversation. Didn't know those could stand on their own, did you?
Okay. Heyo.
And then follow that up with Police Academy, which yep. is another, you know, very goofy movie. And that was the reason why, honestly, Carpenter wanted Kim Cattrall right from the beginning, but the studio didn't want her because mm-hmm. of goofy films like Porky's mm-hmm. and like Police Academy, which again shows that they have no idea what kind of movie John Carpenter was making here, right? They wanted a rock star. And I don't know, like, who were the big rock stars of the day 86? That could fit into this role,
Lea
right?
Ford,
I mean,
maybe?
Like, Debbie Harry,
Lita Ford, Joan Jett.
Lita Ford?
Yeah. Right. Yeah,
Joan Jett.
They could have got Madonna for this, who was at the peak, like her, one of her first multiple peaks.
Oh, yeah, she's an actress. Okay.
So well, she's 86, so this is quite early and not yet an actor. She's mostly a musician here.
A musician
and a dancer in 86, because she's just starting to come into her super duper stardom.
Okay, okay.
But yeah,
yeah, maybe
she'd also
hadn't
be
done Desperately Seeking Susan yet.
Yeah,
maybe?
I think it's right around now.
Interesting.
I'll take a quick
right.
look.
So anyway, they didn't want her, but... Mm-hmm. Carpenter got his way, and Kim Cattrall says she always loved this role because she wasn't just the side, you know, piece. Mm-hmm. She wasn't just the screaming woman, damsel in distress. She is an accomplished, strong lawyer who pushes the plot forward as much as anybody else does. Mm-hmm. And that's what she loved about it. Mm-hmm. Also, she was at the time starring in a stage production. And so she had to be off the set every day at like 4:30 in the afternoon. So they mm-hmm. shot around her schedule. That's how much John Carpenter wanted her for this movie. And so it's really interesting because both the female leads who were supposed to have these emerald green eyes both had brown eyes. And so they had to wear these, and remember, it was hard contacts back in the middle
ages. Yeah.
They were essentially pieces of colored glass. And they bothered her eyes so much that she had to put them in like 45 minutes before they started shooting so that her eyes would stop watering in time to make the camera roll. So yeah, it was a chore for her, but she was very happy to be playing a strong woman in a movie, which
and,
was
you know,
from what she'd done to that point. And then of course she eventually goes on and ends up, you know, being Samantha
Sex and the City.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I mean, that's one of the strongest female characters ever on TV. So, yeah.
But I think that she's always done this. You know, it's interesting because if you want to, you can kind of, you know, poo-poo the roles in Police Academy and Porky's that she chose. But she was the character and the actor were non-apologetic. It wasn't, I want you to like me. I want to do anything. Like, she was there to get hers in, you know, in Porky's, right? It wasn't about, please love me. Right. And she does the same thing here. She ignores Jack Burton every time he's like, hey, little miss, let me see if I can flirt with you. And she's like, I am trying to get shit done.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Dan
exactly.
Baker, don't give me a dollar penalty there. It's true. Or
and,
Nelson.
Kim Cattrall, of course, went on to do sci-fi gold, which she got being Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And speaking of sci-fi gold, we have to talk about, there's Samantha. We have to talk about James Hong. Hey, talk to us about James Hong.
I can't believe I get to talk about James Hong. I feel like this should have been one of you because with this.
Oh.
Victor.
No, it's Victor Wong and James Hong. I screwed those up on the script.
Okay.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Yes. Sorry.
Thank you. Okay.
James Hong. Go ahead.
So this is James Hung. He played Lo Pan, of course.
Yes. Different guy. Whole different guy.
Yes. He was also in the original Blade Runner as Hannibal Chu. And Scott, what does he do?
He only does eyes. I only do eyes.
Wow, it feels so uncomfortable, but yet it shouldn't be.
He's so good in that.
He actually has a long and storied history as a character actor on TV. If you love an 80s TV show, he was probably in that TV show for some part of that time. And the crazy thing about this is his acting chops and his resume are absolutely incredible. Not only is he memorable forever just for that one role, he's been essentially steadily acting as an actor since 1954, and he has two projects in 2021 set for release, including Gremlins, The Secret of the Mogwai TV series. Yep. Are you
kidding still working?
Me?
Dude is still working.
I know. And you know what? That's a 67-year career. Yes. Are you
incredible.
Kidding me?
Not 67 years old. 67 years of acting on the regular. That's incredible.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And to be fair, today, honestly, he might be best known for being the voice of Mr. Ping in Kung Fu Panda.
Yep.
And that is also well deserved.
The
mystery ingredient in my noodle soup.
He's absolutely incredible. Yes, Judge Wolf, there is a new Gremlins TV show which is coming out. And another character actor who is had a long career, is no longer with us, unfortunately, is Mr. Victor Wong, who played Egg Shen. Is that Magic Potion Egg?
Yep.
And he, of course, he's got a massive sci-fi pedigree. Not only Big Trouble in Little China, not only The Golden Child, he was also in Tremors, which is one of my favorite movies. And speaking of The Golden Child, Rob, and he says, let him ask. What does he ask about?
I said, I want the knife.
Mr. Shen did a ton of work. He died in 2001. And he was working quite steadily from 1984, and that's a 17-year run of pretty steady work. The final cast member we will talk about in this movie, because it's got some interesting backstory to it, which I'll pitch it back over. Rob, talk about Dennis Dunn, who played Wang Chi.
Mm. Oh, Wang Chi is the hero of this movie. As much as, you know, Jack Burton doesn't want to admit that, Wang Chi and really Egg Shen, they're even the A1 and the 1A hero. And probably Gracie is after that. So Jack Burton's way down the line, right? Just don't tell 20th Century Fox that. But yeah, Carpenter hired Dennis Dunn, but he wanted Jackie Chan. That was the original thought.
Okay.
And Jackie Chan was barely known in the States. He'd done the small part in Cannonball Run. He'd obviously done, you know, all of his movies overseas, but he wasn't well known and his English wasn't very good. And so they were afraid. I mean, this is Dennis Dunn is, again, the hero. And the big speaker, and he gives all the exposition, and he gives all the backstory, right? And he drives the plot. And with Jackie Chan's broken English, they were just afraid that they couldn't do it. So Dennis Dunn gets the part. Jackie Chan is still in the movie. That first fight between the Chang Sings and the Wing Tong Tang, Jackie Chan is one of the first guys that comes out, and you can still see him in this movie. Unfortunately, he's not one of the warriors later on in the movie, but he's right there in the first scene. So. Yeah, and so Dunn, get this. So he was up for a TV miniseries and Big Trouble in Little China. And his agent said, listen, go with the sure thing. Go with the steady work. Go do the miniseries. But since W.D. Richter had written the script, Dennis Dunn was a huge fan. Did I say Dennis Dunn?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Okay, good. Okay, sorry. He was a huge fan of Buckaroo Banzai, which is what Richter was kind of best known for. And so he decided he wanted to work on the movie that the Buckaroo Banzai guy had written. And so he comes in and he's got it. And he had such a wonderful time working with Victor Wong, the guy who plays Egg Shen. And they had actually worked on some different like plays and stuff around the San Francisco area. They worked together a number of times. Dennis Dunn named his daughter Victoria after Victor Wong.
That's very, very sweet relationship
that they built up. So you've got Jack Burton, and the studio wants him to be the superstar of this movie, but it's really Wang. And you can even tell. So Carpenter wanted to go against, you know, white hero, Asian sidekick. He wanted to flip that on its head, you know. And to show that, he even puts Wang in like an Indiana Jones fedora.
Okay.
The first time we meet him during the gambling scene, mm-hmm. he's got the hero outfit on. He's mm-hmm. ready to take charge of this thing. And part of that was, and this is a great quote from Carpenter, Jack Burton's a guy who's a sidekick but doesn't know it. He's an idiot blowhard. He's an American fool in a world that he doesn't understand. And I think that encompasses him so much. If he does not have Wang, mm-hmm. none of the stuff that happens
Correct.
Happens. I mean, there's a yeah. there's this great couple of scenes where Jack Burton takes himself out of the fight. And when he finally comes back to it, Wang has basically already kicked everybody's butt, right? Because mm-hmm. again, Wang's the hero of yes. this movie.
Yes.
And the nice thing about having Jack Burton as the hero, the sidekick who doesn't know he's not the hero, is he's mm-hmm. never bothered by that. He's just like, yeah. oh, thank you for doing this.
He's unaware.
Thank you for
he's unaware.
And that makes it lovely because if he's aware, like we see that trope a lot too, where the hero's unqualified but doesn't want to admit it, and mm-hmm. then mm-hmm. that changes every dynamic because then he's. Putting he all of his staff, so to speak, is or team is put upon, and that doesn't happen here. And I think that that's really lovely. What's happening with my voice? Do you hear that?
It just reflected off the paper.
Oh, okay.
That's all.
Yeah. Jack Burton doesn't know he's unqualified.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the interesting thing. Take Jack Burton out of this movie. What happens differently? The only big thing he gets is that it's all in the reflexes, and he's the one that gets Lopan.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else could have done that. Everything else in this movie would have happened without Jack Burton mm-hmm. exactly the way that it happened.
And
I'm
it,
just saying.
It also sort of teaches you inherently or teaches the audience inherently that the being a hero is not about getting the hero accolades. It's about doing the job.
Mm-hmm.
And we get that is true of Dunn's character is totally true. He just wants his girl. He wants this deal over and he wants his life to continue and mm-hmm. that's it. And Jack is of course like the hero of his own story and that sort of thing.
Robbie, speaking of which, so to that point, Scotty, let me jump right into the next point mm-hmm. that we have on here, right? Is that the opening scene that feels tacked on and not attached to anything else that happens in the movie. It's when Egg Shen is in his lawyer's office
uh-huh.
and he's saying, Jack Burton is a hero. Leave Jack Burton alone. What he did for us, you guys will never know. The studio forced Carpenter to put that in the movie. It should have opened up with the blowhard talking on his CB from the Pork Chop
right.
Express
right.
and just everyone knowing, well, this guy's an idiot. Right? This guy's obviously an idiot. Okay? But it opens with that scene instead because, again, 20th Century Fox didn't know
didn't
that Jack Burton wasn't the star of this movie. And so they needed something at the beginning to set everybody up to say, Jack Burton is the hero of this movie, even though everything that happens
right.
after that
right.
scene tells the exact opposite story.
And Rob, this, despite the fact that they didn't know what movie they had and they made these strange demands on the movie, it's become such a cult classic and has endured yeah. over 35, campy but enduring. How on earth could this fail at the box office?
It's honestly an excellent question, Scotty, because all of the pre-screenings, everybody loved this movie.
Right.
Carpenter
right.
and Russell. Yeah, they thought they had a huge hit on their hand. And all of the, if you go back and look at any of Kurt Russell's interviews, you know, when he was stumping for the movie before it opened,
mm-hmm.
that's what they were talking about. How huge this is going to be. They thought they had the next Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh,
that's
wow.
what this movie was in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then 20th Century Fox, they didn't know what they had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you even look at the posters, the one that you put on the, you know, our opening, you know, thing and to promote this, Scott,
uh-huh.
the white one is again, Jack Burton smack dab in the middle. You also got Gracie there. The original poster is the green one, which is just Jack Burton smack dab in the middle. And it's kind of almost a Star Wars callback where Gracie's on the ground hugging his leg. I mean, they even got Gracie wrong for God's sake.
Okay.
But none of the Asian heroes, Dennis Dunn, Egg Shen, none of these guys are on the poster.
Wow.
Right? This
yeah.
is, as far as 20th Century Fox was concerned, this is a Jack Burton movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it just bombed. They didn't know how to promote this weird,
yeah.
funny action ghost movie, and they screwed the whole thing up.
What's so interesting about that is I know a lot of you in the chat room and a lot of you listening to this podcast at a later date will remember that you, Scott, you talk all the time about early in your career, one of the biggest things that you had was a rejection letter that went kind of like, you know, this is great. It's just, I have no idea where to, is it sports? Mm-hmm. Is it sci-fi? Is it thrill? Like, I don't know where to put you on a bookshelf. Mm-hmm. And now that matters less because people find content in different ways. But back in the day when you were writing a book, the way you did that is you went to a bookstore to buy it almost assuredly. And then that mattered what shelf it was on. I feel like part of the reason that this movie failed is what Rob brought up at the top of the podcast where 20th Century Fox got... I wonder if there was an executive who was like, this will succeed or it will not blemish my reputation and gave it 1 week. 1 week was New York and L.A. Like, what are you thinking? Like one week back in the 80s wasn't even a wide release. That doesn't happen until week three. So this got probably fine numbers, but not great numbers in its launch cities. And then it got pulled for a while. For no reason, you know? It doesn't make any sense, but that, of course, would make the movie fail. No question.
And it was you speak to that, Scotty? You've probably experienced that, haven't you?
The things not getting promoted?
Yeah, the things not getting promoted, and mostly because they don't understand what they have.
That's always a big part of any entertainment. When you're working with a publisher, you're working with a movie studio, etc. The people in charge of marketing the thing need to have either a good understanding or want to throw a bunch of money to promote it, or hopefully the best of both. Going back to Infected, my first book, it was signed by Steve Ross, who at the time was in charge of Random House. He was the guy. And they were going to spend all this money, they're going to do all this stuff to make me, quote unquote, the next Stephen King. And then 2 weeks after I got signed, he was gone. And then it went to other people who did an admirable job. But if the studio believes in the film and is willing to spend the money to get the film out to people, it's going to have a much better chance. And this movie had no chance, but it was up against some pretty stiff competition. Weirdly, in that for American cinema, 1996, there were two supernatural Asian themed action movies coming out, and Rob, and that was The Golden Child, which we mentioned earlier, and Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, and what the studio figured, what 20th Century Fox figured was, well, we can't beat Eddie Murphy. He's the hottest thing out there right now. Yeah. So that's originally why they said, well, if we get Nicholson or Eastwood, okay, maybe we can go up against Eddie Murphy. And when they couldn't do that, they said, well, then let's not go up against Eddie Murphy. Let's get our mystical Asian movie out there before The Golden Child. So they actually pushed up production. Carpenter only had 12 weeks to like get this movie ready and then start shooting. Okay. And it did end up coming out like 5 months before The Golden Child, but did much worse than The Golden Child. Not that The Golden Child did a huge amount at the box office, but yeah, this movie completely flopped. And to your point, had they just trusted it and said, well, you know, listen, we already got this movie in the can, we might as well start moving it around the country. Mm-hmm. This is one of those word of mouth movies. And the fact that we're talking about it 35 For sure. years later proves that when one person sees it, they tell the next person about it.
Yep.
And I guarantee that box office would have gone up.
Yeah, for sure.
If they just would have left it in theaters.
Well, and I will tell you, I also think this is true. If in the beginning, back in the 80s, when there was no digital media, that when there was only TV channels and there were barely VHS and Betamax tapes and stuff like that, you where you were in the world determined whether or not you went to the movies. So, of course, they do the pre-release, the small releases in big cities like Miami or New York or San Francisco or L.A., but just those two because there's a bigger population there. And they're going to get representative numbers of when they wide release it while they're still printing the prints. You know, those next 2 weeks, they're still printing extra prints and trying to decide how many to make. If they had already done that, and if they had put it out in wide release, especially in the Midwest, in the United States, because things went domestic and then international, I hate to say it, but you boys would have gone to watch that three times in a row that first weekend.
Yes, we would have.
You would have gone because it was the one thing to do that Friday that was the most fun. Mm-hmm. And then you would have gone right back because it was swell. But they hamstrung themselves. They took that chance away from themselves to actually let the movie shine where it would, which is people who don't have 400 things to choose from, but people who have, you know, 50 things to choose from. It is always going to win, which is why we love it today. Because, you know, we have the time to put it where it belongs.
It's really stood up and done the test of time.
But because of this, Scotty, this is why John Carpenter for a long time refused to work with a big studio anymore.
Okay.
He was just like, all right, you guys screwed this up from the get-go. You didn't know the type of movie I was going to make. You forced me to add extra scenes. Mm-hmm. You kept it in the theaters for a week and then dumped it. Screw you guys. I am out. So even though he made They Live a couple years later, Prince of Darkness after that, those were not big studio pictures. He found smaller studios that would just give him 100% control. Mm-hmm. And that's how he produced his movies for the next 20 years.
That's pretty impressive. So that's a general summary of the movie. We've got a bunch of little details that we're going to go into now. And one of my favorites is the Chinese writing that is on the wall. John Carpenter shows his vanity a little bit, not only by doing the theme music and the music for the whole thing. The entire soundtrack is done by John Carpenter.
Sure.
The song we listened to earlier is John Carpenter's band, John Carpenter singing, and John Carpenter probably producing everything else. And then the Chinese writing we see in the main title translates to evil spirits make a big scene in little spiritual state.
Close enough.
And then he also throws
when lightning dies, Scotty.
When lightning dies.
When lightning dies, there's all this crackling lightning, right? And when he finally gets crushed. And then there's this little Chinese character that comes up in the crackling lightning. Uh-huh. And it's the character for Carpenter. Of course, a throwback to the director himself.
I absolutely love that. I do love, there's a few things that that Kurt Russell does in this movie. And I'm not sure if it's in every movie, but this seems to be his way of getting into a character. There are several little things that are his that he brings to Jack Burton. He has those crazy moccasin boots made so that he can wear them. And he also, there's a scene where he enters the brothel and he's in a costume. And that's actually a costume or a recreation of a character from a different movie, a movie called Used Cars.
That's right. Oh my gosh.
So which to me means as an actor, he's like, all right, so if I have to pretend to be somebody, like I'd be that guy from Used Cars. Sure.
I could be Ryan Russo again.
And because
he
was Ryan Russo for so long, that helps.
Rudy Russo.
What's going on with that?
That's what I'm saying. Look at this. It keeps pegging.
We'll bring that down and I'll put this here and like lean a little closer to her.
Guys, we don't need to hear about your pegging. It's okay.
Oh my God, Becky.
This is a family show. That is definitely worth
and
a dollar.
And this movie also had a huge influence on one of the most, if not the most enduring video game franchise, which is Mortal Kombat. And a lot of people who play Mortal Kombat in the day are familiar with Raiden. And Raiden was directly inspired and stolen, if you will, directly from this movie. So this movie's influence not only goes into pop culture and cult movies in general, has influenced one of the greatest video games of all time.
And Lo Pan is almost directly a steal of Shang Tsung, right? Shang Tsung in the Mortal Kombat basically is Lo Pan, right? I mean, they took two characters from this and put them in Mortal Kombat, just completely stole them. Finish him.
And this is Egg Shen's offices in Fire Station 23 in downtown Los Angeles. That is a popular film location, including it is the main office in Ghostbusters. Sweet. It was also used in Flatliners, The Mask, and Police Academy 2, which did not include King Cattrall.
She did not come back for the sequels.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure she knew she did her best work for the Police Academy.
Forward a little bit there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'll keep an eye. We're having some small audio problem, ladies and gentlemen, so I'm trying to shoot it on the fly. But if you lean in a little bit, I think it's some echo from the wall.
I think so too. But every once in a while, it'll peg into the red, so I'm trying to be careful. No, nothing from you, Rob. No words from you.
All in all, we're just another echo from the wall.
Rob, what are some of your other favorite bits from this movie?
So it's interesting because A, you talked about character choices and that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. Well, there's one thing that Jack Burton is really known for that turns out it wasn't a character choice. The whole second half of the movie, like, you know, when he's just in his little, you know, tank top with the crazy logo on it and that kind of stuff, he is sweating profusely. I mean, he is glowing. There's so much sweat.
Sure.
And you think that's just, you know, a choice. They're probably spraying him down in between takes or something like that. Now, turns out he had a really bad case of the flu and was sweating the whole time. So probably when they're going down in the elevator and he's saying, is it hot in here or is it just me? It was just him because he was just like just dripping sweat because his body was fighting the flu. And it works so well because, listen, Jack Burton is in he has no idea what the hell's going on. He doesn't know where he is and what he's doing.
Uh-huh.
And he is glistening from the nervousness and, of course, the, you know, digestive tract issues that he's having at the same time.
That's just one of, and you and I have been watching this movie for a long time, and that's always been one of the callback scenes. Out of all the fun stuff in this movie, just the riding down the elevator, that I'm feeling pretty good. Yeah, me too. Just kind of weird, calm work.
Positivity, I feel positive attitude everywhere.
So we watched this movie in the last couple of weeks. See what it does at Pegs.
I'll keep an eye on it,
So we watched this
movie. You
really
need to find a different word, because I'm going to call back at that.
It's fair. Having him have to come in and do the work of what he's doing, and him being an actor of his ilk at the time, like, he also learns to drive a big rig, which is completely unnecessary in this scene, because all he's doing is that first scene where he's driving over the bridge, where I'm not really sure that was shot live over the bridge, because he's eating that ginormous sandwich. And we talked about it when we were watching the ginormous sandwich scene, because I'm like, oh my God, it starts out so ridiculous. But thanks to you, Rob, I found out that, you know, of course, it's called the Pork Chop Express, and it's probably a pig transport, right? Because as Rob said at the top of the hour, like, he's supposed to be, in the original script, he was bringing food, meat, to Chinese railroad workers in San Francisco. So it's the Pork
Chop
Express.
Can't make pork lo mein without pigs, I'm just saying.
Filled with pigs. And I found out from you, Rob, that he's eating a ham sandwich. And he's just a mess with it, which is such a character note, too. Like, he's and it's insane. And then as he gets out of the car in Chinatown, or the cab, sorry, in Chinatown, he's still got a little sandwich left. I'm like, oh my God, it's like 6 feet long. Come on, also nothing from you, Rob. Don't mention the 6 feet long. But, like, how long was that sandwich that he's eating it for? An hour.
Yeah. Rob, give us another tip here. I try and see if I can do about A's mic.
Yeah, no worries. Let's talk about, so, rain, thunder, and lightning. Those are, like, the three lieutenants of Lo Pan, right? And Peter Kwong's a guy that plays Rain, and he actually didn't realize until they shot one of the final battle scenes that he was in a comedy. He thought this was a straightforward Chinese martial arts kung fu movie. And then when he's fighting Dennis Dunn, and Dennis does the thing with his eyebrows where he kind of goes, see, I can do that too. That's when he went, oh, hell, this is a freaking comedy. He shot the whole movie all serious, which is good, because you need, for real comedy, you need some people to play it straight. And so all the villains play it straight, well, other than Lo Pan, who's completely over the top. But the three lieutenants play this completely straight. And Peter Kwong was one of them, right? He also loved that long, luxurious hair that he got to wear. It cost like $3,000, and he had to sit in the chair for hours to put that hair on. But he was just like, man, when I get that hair on, I am freaking Rain. I am this guy.
I hope he got to go out carousing while they were shooting this.
I hope he did.
You got that hair. You got to go out. And whatever your preferences are, when you got that hair, you're going to get some attention. I think
I won't take too long on this, but I've told you before, I know a clown who went to the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Clown School back in the 80s in Florida. And would literally I'm just going to go home and take a shower and, you know, like, be in whiteface. And to get from the school to his car in, like, where he'd parked so he wouldn't have to pay for it, he'd walk past a few bars. And after a while, he just accepted, like, okay, there are apparently girls who like clowns. Like, he would leave his makeup on to go out. So I bet for sure Rain absolutely was like, can I take this
I hope
home
he
with
did.
Me?
Hell yeah. He better got him laid because of that hair. Because that hair was
it took
gorgeous.
So long. Yeah.
It was impressive. It was impressive. Hair. And we've not talked about Susie Pai, who played Mao Yin, but Susie Pai was a playmate in 1985 or 86 or something like that. So a very attractive human being. And
she's a gorgeous human.
And during the wedding scene with Lo Pan, when he pokes her with the needle and she flinches, he actually stabbed her in there. And that blood is real. Did you know that?
Yeah. And that.
credit to her, stayed in character.
She didn't break character.
Stayed in
That's
the
right.
scene. And, you know, because she does not have a lot to her acting resume. But for that scene, she got stabbed with the needle and she was like, I'm in it to win it.
Yeah, well, there was some pretty good Freudian stuff. I believe that was called like the needle of piercing, or the long needle of love, or something like that. And the sword was like, you know, the sword of burning, or something like
the
that.
The burning sword.
There's some pretty phallic stuff going on with Lopan. I'm just saying.
Well, we will finish this up. There's one more detail, and that is the very strange. Those of you who played Dungeons & Dragons, and you're now playing Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes, I am.
Have you come across a beholder yet?
I have not.
A beholder, as in Eye of the Beholder, is a very famous...
See how tricky they are?
One of the most iconic D&D monsters out there is orcs, goblins, and the beholders on almost everything in one cover or another, because it's kind of a marketing thing. So that floating eye, that floating eye with the other floating eyes.
As a character and on my campaign, I haven't seen it.
That is basically a beholder. And remember, this is pre-CGI. So that was... it was created by Screaming Mad George, effects legend Screaming Mad George, who called it the most difficult thing I've ever been asked to create. And over 60 artists and engineers worked on it for that. That's in three scenes. And
yeah, what is it, like 45 seconds of screen?
Maybe. And because of all the moving parts, that cost $100,000 just to make the floating eye, which doesn't really impact the plot all that much other than, oh, Lopan now knows you guys are here.
Right, and today wouldn't be anywhere near the same, it wouldn't cost nearly as much because some of that movement and whatever would be CGI.
I think it would be all CGI at this point. I think it would be all CGI.
Yeah. No doubt about it. And some of the eyes from that still exist, like some of the people who created it have little parts of it.
Oh, how
but
cool.
But the thing as a whole, unfortunately, doesn't still exist because I guarantee that would be one of those pieces of memorabilia that some crazy Big Trouble in Little China fan would pay $1 million for, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, for sure.
Totally.
And I do think, have we covered what we need to cover for this? I'm having so much mic trouble.
We're gonna close this up because the mic troubles are giving us a lot of problems today.
As much as we're going to leave right now, we will also be back on March 7th, and we're going to be watching PCU March 7th, watch PCU. It's a comedy about political correctness run amok at a university.
It's made in 1994, which goes to show you that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
And tonight at the pit, everybody gets laid.
This movie starred Jeremy Piven, Jon Favreau, David Spade, and more. And Rob...
And Alex Desaire. So this will be the second Alex Desaire, Jon Favreau movie in three sessions we're doing.
Ties back to Swingers. Both of those gentlemen were in Swingers. Rob, thank you very much for being on the show as usual. Are you a fan of PC, Rob?
Oh, yes, I am. I am a dirty meat tosser. So, I'm definitely a fan of that movie.
Well, Rob, we will
watch in 2 weeks. You'll understand that wasn't as dirty as it just sounded.
But you know, how can they tell with all the other things you've been saying the whole time? Rob, thank you for being on, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Love you.
All right, AK, let's finish up this podcast, and now we'll go to work on that microphone and see what's going on.
Okay, so this was episode 65 of Story Smack. You can always find Scott and I online. Scott is at Scott Sigler on Twitter and Instagram, and his Facebook page is facebook.com/Scott Sigler. I am at A Real Girl on Twitter and at A.Real.Girl on Instagram.
And you can find us online at facebook.com/StorySmack. We live stream Story Smack every other Saturday at facebook.com/Scott Sigler, twitch.tv/Scott Sigler, and youtube.com/Scott Sigler.
In addition to Story Smack, we do a once weekly live stream called Sigler in Place. It's on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific time, right here where you're watching us now.
And we release an unabridged episode of one of my books every week. It is serialized. That is a podcast. That is all free. You can get episodes at iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and more, or just subscribe to it however you choose using any of those formats at scottsigler.com/subscribe.
And we sure do hope that you subscribe so that you can hear Scott's books and more Story Smack goodness in the future.
Until the next episode, we will talk to you all real soon.